Hello and welcome to another edition of the Advent IM podcast. And I'm delighted today to be joined by Chris Recker from Trowers and Hamlins, who is an associate at Trowers and Hamlins and a solicitor. And if for no other reason at all, then you very rarely get to listen to a solicitor for half an hour for free, then you should continue listening to this podcast. Chris, good morning and welcome.
Morning. Thanks, Mike. I think that's absolutely right. Very rarely do you get to listen to a solicitor for half an hour for free. As Mike said, I'm an associate at Trowers and Hamlins. My specialism is civil fraud and investigation work, but my real interest within that is resolving cases where there is a cyber or a data angle. So that includes cyber crime, data breach response, and everything in between, including asset recovery, and asset recovery where cryptocurrency or virtual currency is involved. So cybercrime is something that's more and more prevalent on a day-to-day basis, and some of the things we're going to talk today about relate to how organizations can take steps to stop being affected by cybercrime, and what the challenges that those organizations might see in the next 12 to 18 months with or without Brexit.
Great, the B thank word you. Already. The B word, and there we go. I saw a great cartoon actually the other day in the newspaper. There's two guys with briefcases talking, and one says, "My father was a Brexit negotiator, and his father before him," which seems to pretty much sum up the situation we found ourselves in at the moment. I digress. And for those of you who don't know or haven't listened to the Advent IM podcast before, where have you been, and why not? My name is Mike Gillespie, and I'm the managing director here at Advent IM. So one of the things I'm quite interested in is the language that's used around cybercrime and almost the way in which it is set up to be something special, something different, not really a crime in some cases, often in some ways treated as white collar crime rather than actual crime. And I thought that might be something that we could start to look at. Is why we treat cybercrime as being somehow special or different, or in some cases even something to look up to.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think part of this comes from the way in which it's investigated by the authorities. So, of course, you know, the police and other investigation agencies have departments that are focusing on cyber-related incidents. And therefore, the moment often there is a cyber spin to something, it tends to get pulled into one of those departments rather than perhaps looked at as a whole. So if you have something that may appear on its face to be an act of terrorism, it's often first investigated as a cyber incident because of the effects that it can have on things like critical infrastructure, perhaps rather than what it actually really is, which might be a form of terrorism. It is interesting. I'm not sure why it is that we see it like that, and I can only imagine that it's because technology is ultimately an enabler for fraud, and the fraudsters are often ahead of the curve on these points, and everyone else is left trying to chase behind them. I don't know if you've got a view on that as well.
Well, I often think that, you know, when we see, we were talking before we started the podcast, but if you disable the National Health Service with ransomware, and then it's reported as being ransomware, actually what you've just done is put hundreds of people's health and potentially lives at risk. Now, in the real world, that would be classed as an act of terrorism. If you bring a plane down out of the sky because you're on board with a weapon, then that is terrorism. But if you bring planes down using a cyber attack, it's somehow different. If you walk into a bank with a sawn-off shotgun, it's armed robbery. But you take millions out of the bank with a computer, it's cybercrime. And they're treated so differently, and the punishments are so vastly different. And I sometimes think, you know, are we legitimizing cybercrime by treating it as being somehow special?
That's interesting. And I think part of that is the way in which people can commit crime is changing. And there's an interesting shift in the dynamic of criminal activity, because you have, of course, action fraud suggests that 70% of all fraud now is cyber enabled. And I'm sure that number will continue to grow, continue to go up. You know, the days of intercepting mail and doing things like that are slowly going to come to an end, because it's a lot easier to intercept somebody's email account and create a false persona based on information that you might be able to get just from open source intelligence inquiries. So I think there's a mindset change that's come with that, and maybe the point is that what we perceive to be terrorism will now be perceived to be cybercrime, and that's the shift, and it's and that's just because a lot of these, because technology is that enabler, and technology is the factor and the vessel through which these attacks can happen. Fraudsters are ahead of the curve, but they're also very lazy and very risk averse, I think. so there are lots of interesting points around there, and you know, one of the things I think we wanted to talk about was Carbonac, and of course you have a situation there where this ultimately lots of ATMs are systematically emptied, and you know, in the region of $1 billion is removed from over 100 banks in 40 countries in a very short space of time. And what does it all come down to? It all comes down to fraudsters using being very good at what they do, creating false personas to convince individuals within the bank or each bank to click on a certain link or to open an attachment which would inject a piece of malware and allow them to gain access to the system so that they could do all the things that they needed to do. And the breakdown in that problem is the person. So when you look at people, processes and technology, you can have the best processes in the world, you can have the best cybersecurity professionals, a security operations center, threat hunters, whatever you have, but the person is the breakdown in the chain. And it's about that education piece around that. You know, have you looked just to check where this email account has come from? And you know, sometimes these emails are very, very, very convincing, and that's exactly what I think what happened here. I mean, how about in terms of your client base? Have you seen many affected by Carbonac type incidents, or what's your?
Yes, I mean, in some ways, and I think, you know, although this has become something that's talked about a lot now, actually there's a big part of me that sometimes thinks we're not learning a lesson from this. You know, I've been in the security world long enough that I remember the first truly successful global virus, the Isle of Vue virus, 20 years ago now, which arrived as an attachment in an email, relied on people believing that somebody they'd never met before had fallen in love with them and sent them a love letter, and thousands of people opened it and got infected as a result of that. And actually, that MO in 20 years hasn't changed, whether it's an attachment in an email, whether it's a phishing email, whether it's a Nigerian prince promising to launder his money through your bank account, eBay telling you they've had to freeze your account, your bank account telling you that there's a problem with your bank, DHL, HMRC voluntarily emailing you to tell you that they owe you money. I mean, come on, very how kind. Often does that happen? And yet people are still falling for the same. It's almost like the doorstep fraud. People are still being doorstepped. And I think it is an education issue here. And I know that, you know, companies that we talk to who do things like phishing exercises are saying that actually they are still being hugely successful, because employees are still falling for the same old trick. So I think there's an education element here that's being missed, possibly because we're still thinking the technology is going to save us rather than recognizing that it's a people problem.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I know some organizations, when they do the phishing testing, they'll also test their staff's personal email accounts as well to see whether or not, and they'll do it by saying, click here for your free iPad, or click here for your 50% discount on your iPad, and it will look like it's coming from Apple. And ultimately, if they do click on it, the employer gets a notification, and then they can have a conversation. Because of course, if you're connected to your employer's Wi-Fi, for example, and you click on a link like that, that can have, depending on the malware that's attached, that can have serious consequences for letting something into the network. I mean, ultimately, cybersecurity is a really interesting and developing area. We're spending more and more and more, and businesses are spending more and more on this on these issues. Yet the volume of attacks, the losses that are occurring as a result, is going up and up and up as well. You know, you'd expect the more you spend, the volume to drop off. I think it's going to be the new norm, and you have polar opposites. You have massive PLCs, massive businesses that have huge budgets, very challenging infrastructures perhaps, but have the money to educate their staff, that have the money to do these things. And then you have on the opposite end of the scale, the smaller businesses that need to do something, but what can they do at a cost-effective rate? And that's where I think you have things like Cyber Essentials, Cyber Essentials Plus, that is at least better than doing nothing, but it's still not the complete solution. It's a continuous project. And when you look at GDPR that came in, obviously May 18, there's some really interesting points about, well, it was everyone doing this just because of GDPR. And you know, a good example, historically, we would see if you had an employee that stole some emails or some confidential information, the first question that we used to get asked was, can we stop this employee going to a competitor? Can we stop them from disclosing the confidential information? And the answer is yes, absolutely, we can do that. If there are restrictive covenants, you can get injunctions and use the court's mechanisms to do that. But we've had it now. The question now we're asked is, do we have to disclose this to the ICO? That's the bigger concern. What they're less concerned about is the confidential information being disclosed and therefore the confidential aspect of that information being lost by virtue of that disclosure. So the shift and the concern about this is massive. And I think now that you've got the ICO having, in trying to fine, or intending to fine, I should say, Marriott and BA, you know, huge sums of money, organisations are now realising that they need to do something. I don't know if that's your perception of this as well.
Yeah, I think certainly GDPR was undoubtedly very well marketed. Not always in an accurate way. And I think businesses have, to an extent, woken up to the need to do data protection well, which is interesting given that a huge part of GDPR actually is exactly the same as it was in the 98 legislation, which is know what you've got, know why you've got it, use it for those purposes, keep it safe and secure, don't send it to dodgy countries or dodgy people, have proper supply chain assurance in place, get rid of it safely and securely when you no longer need it.
Yep.
There you go, I could have written GDPR in 5 minutes. but I think that what a lot of businesses have done as a result of that is seen data protection as being something new and an overhead and a project. We hear a lot of organizations saying, I've done GDPR.
Yeah.
We became compliant, as opposed to this is business as usual and this is how we run our organizations.
Absolutely right, yeah.
But also, I think that both GDPR and indeed the term cyber, again, they are dragging resources into projects and into technologies. And in some cases, that water's been muddied, of course, by the same old, snake oil sales process of buy our technology, it'll make you compliant.
Yeah.
At the World Data Protection Forum, I even saw a company selling software that apparently, if you buy their software, immediately makes you compliant to all known legislation. Which I thought was fantastic. And in exchange for a huge amount of money, they gave you three beans. So I do think, that sort of cyber amulet mentality does prevail and is detracting from the bigger problem.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So you mentioned action fraud and the 70% figure.
Yeah.
And of course, that's just the number of incidents that are reported.
Mm-hmm.
So, the police are saying that actually that's potentially only, 3 or 4% of what's actually going on out there as well.
Mm.
So the numbers are potentially quite frighteningly big. When you think about it. So why do you think so many criminals are using the internet as their preferred mode now of committing crime, and particularly for fraudsters?
I think it's the availability of data. It's now easy for a fraudster to change who they are, to change where they might be, to pretend to be somebody, to build up fake personas. And I think the fraudsters in the past that would do things like set up fake bank accounts and literally turn up in branch every week and pay cash in to build up a rapport with the bank manager so that it all appeared to be legitimate before selling that bank account to somebody to do whatever they need to do because it appears clean. The days of that versus being able to apply to remortgage a property online, if you have enough information about somebody and about the property, you can do that online in minutes now. Mm. So I think it's, you know, data ultimately is the new oil. It's a commodity that can be traded, it's a commodity that can be sold, and we are all perhaps too keen to share information with various websites, with various Facebook quizzes. In fact, down to, I know some people that won't use Snapchat filters because they're convinced that Snapchat are storing pictures of people's faces, which could then unlock an iPhone as a result. Whether or not that's true, put that to one side. But the point remains, you know, there's a considerable amount of information that we are voluntarily providing. Mm-hmm. And unless you, and this goes back to the education piece, unless you know how to make everything private and know what you should or shouldn't be sharing, that information can easily be accessed and can be used to build a fake email account. Again, going back to that, you know, if somebody sits and watches an email inbox and sees, okay, oh, they've ordered these things from Amazon, if I send an email pretending to be from Amazon in relation to asking for information about that product, are you going to click on it and reply to it? Maybe, you're more likely to. So yeah. It's easier for these fraudsters, I think, to make it more believable versus the turning up at the doorstep fraud, if you can call it that, and going back to the risk of getting caught. Technology is an unfortunate enabler, because on the other side, of course, it allows businesses to trade and bring their services to customers that they perhaps couldn't access before. It cuts both ways, unfortunately.
So we have this sort of globalized commercialism, but that's opening up avenues for criminals as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, when you talk about the dark web and you talk about the way that that goes down, I know quite a few people that refer to the dark web as capitalism personified, and they say, you know, you can buy and sell hacking services on there. You can rate 4 or 5 stars. If they haven't done a good job, they'll get a bad rating. That's not good for business. But these are professional hackers that some will charge, you know, hundreds of dollars an hour, probably, you know. So it's serious work. People do this as a day job. You know, it's the same with buying and selling guns. People, you know, drug dealers on the dark web want to sell drugs to people. If they sell drugs to somebody, chances are they've got friends that want to buy drugs, so they want their drugs to be good. And if the drugs that they sell you are bad, then you'll give them a bad review, and then that can have that's bad for business. So they might give you another batch for free. And it's the same with credentials as well. So someone might sell you credentials or credit card numbers, and if they don't work, they'll give you another 2 or 3 for nothing. The dark web is it's a marketplace. It's a very, very scary marketplace. Unfortunately, the authorities are very much alive to that, and they are working on these forums to try and shut this down. But it's a beast in its own right, is probably what I would say.
So I mean, what you're describing here is a professional career type criminality,
yeah.
Combined with, you know, technical capabilities. And often when we see it in the press, the image we're given of a hacker, for example, is, you know, a teenager sitting in a darkened room, usually in a hoodie, hunched over a computer, and permanently followed everywhere they go by Matrix graphics in the background. there's a big difference between that image and what we're talking about here, which is criminality professionalized, a day job, seeking good ratings, you know, almost a criminal version of TripAdvisor. Yeah. Using the darknet as a commercial mode of selling their services rather than just doing it because they can. And yeah. that's a very different issue that we're talking about here, particularly when we talk about the globalized element of the internet, lack of jurisdiction. Policing, it becomes a major problem because the location of the crime, the victim and the perpetrator are no longer the same place. How do you approach that from a legal perspective within the legal profession?
Yeah.
This must be a major headache for you.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So it's very challenging. So when you're looking at it from a criminal investigation perspective, you're talking about cooperation between lots of jurisdictions. And if you're talking about taking down well-known pages on the darknet that do very bad things, if you read about them, you'll see that there's been cooperation from police forces in lots of different jurisdictions. And when you look at, for example, the fight against financial crime, fraud, money laundering, corruption, across the, from a global perspective, the success and failure often hinges on the ability for those organisations, the NCA, the FBI, whoever it may be, to share information with each other. So that's why I think the police forces do that and work with those other forces to combat those issues. But when you're talking about civil remedies, one of the particular challenges that we see is the speed at which money is moved. So you have a push payment fraud, or you have whatever has happened and money or assets have been misappropriated. Unless you catch it really early, and without talking about cryptocurrency, because that adds another spin on everything, if you're talking about physical money transfers, if you don't catch it early, the money will be moved into accounts in various jurisdictions and it will be gone. And we've had cases where we've worked with professionals to trace IP addresses, and we've traced people all over Europe, including Far East Europe, and I suppose gives you a flavour for the types of characters that we're working with. And in some of these jurisdictions, there are recognised methods for combating these individuals. You can go to court. The courts are able. Are able to grant interim injunctions to restrain things from happening. The ISPs over there have to keep certain information. So if you're trying to track, if you trace an IP address to an ISP in a different jurisdiction, the amount of information they will have to keep on their customers will differ. So in some jurisdictions it's easier to do that. Some jurisdictions are inherently private, and these are the challenges that we come across day in, day out, because the days of just transferring money are, I think, slowly are over ultimately. And because technology is that, and it allows people to change who and where they are, bounce IP addresses through VPNs and do, I'm not going to say it's a complete solution, because you can break them down. It just takes a long time. It slows the whole process down. So when you are tracing these people, it's very difficult. But ultimately, if you're dealing with an organized crime gang, or irrespective of if it's an organized crime gang or if it's an individual, if they've taken millions of pounds, are they going to be able to repay it? So there's a really interesting case was quite groundbreaking in the fraud and asset tracing world not that long ago, and it was called CMOC and Persons Unknown. And the whole preface about this case was that a business had been subject to an email diversion fraud, where somebody had sat in had essentially accessed the CEO's email account, waited for payment emails to be sent, had watched the mechanism that was done to authorise these payments, and had jumped in, created a few false personas, put also rules on the email accounts, and before you know it, extracted many millions of pounds. And those individuals, that's predominantly that's a cyber crime incident, it's a cyber fraud. If to use, again, going back to language, and what the business did was it went to court and it got a freezing injunction against Persons Unknown. And the significance of that was that it could say, I have permission, or I have a court order that allows me to freeze and hold and restrain the traceable proceeds of my money and of this fraud. Historically, what you would have to do is every time you found a new account, you would have to go back to court to perhaps widen the scope of that order. And that takes a lot of time because you're then having to prepare all the documents to go back. You're back in court, you get the order, you have to serve it. It's very difficult. And this money in that case had been transferred to lots of jurisdictions, to lots of banks. And by using this mechanism, they were able to freeze quite a bit of the money before it was dissipated. And they also, in the context of that, got disclosure from lots of the banks. And they found who this individual was because it was they found that one of these, eventually it had gone into somebody's personal account. So they're now in the process of pursuing those people. And they may look at criminal proceedings. I don't know if that's something they're being that they're considering. But there are lots of options that come around that. But the courts are trying to help, are trying to help the victims of the of fraud now, and they're recognising that there are significant challenges, and that the law does need to change on the criminal side. You know, of course, you've got the Fraud Act that sits, governs specific fraud offences. You've got AML offences under the Proceeds of Crime Act. You've got bribery offences under the Bribery Act. You've got insider trading and market abuse offences, but cybercrime offences specifically, you've got the old Computer Misuse Act, which is outdated.
Horribly out of date.
Yeah. Needs updating. Not easy to read. Difficult I fear that some of these offences fall into the too hard category, and that's the challenge.
And I suppose there's the challenge that the technology and therefore the crimes themselves are moving faster than the legislation can keep up.
Yeah.
And of course, so much of our money these days is electronic, you know. And, you know, so many people are doing, you know, e-banking and, I know lots of people now very rarely have cold hard cash in their wallet or their purse because they're just so used to tap and go and electronic transfers and things like that. So I guess it increases the ease with which these crimes can be perpetrated.
Absolutely.
But also the potential reward. You know, you were talking about taking, you know, millions of pounds out of a fraudulent transaction. You have to work very hard in the real world in order to make that sort of money.
Yeah.
And again, you know, potentially the risk if you get caught are quite low because the potential is you'll get prosecuted under something, white collar crime rather than bank robbery. And you're talking about Carbonac, and I think some of our listeners might not be familiar with Carbonac, so it might be worth us just sort of picking that apart and seeing what actually happened there.
Yeah.
You know, I think when you consider that money these days really is just bits and bytes, it's just computer transactions. So the ability to just create money, if you can get into a banking system, is, you know, an incredibly attractive proposition.
Yeah.
Combined with the fact that we have a huge amount of operational technology that is on the periphery of our core systems. So video surveillance systems, you'd mentioned, you know, automated transaction machines, ATMs. You know, we know that a lot of those, for a long time actually, have been publicly talked about as having inherent vulnerabilities because the software is out of date.
Yeah.
I know certain forecourts were still using Windows CE on pay at pump systems until quite recently. You know, horribly out of date, peripheral systems, not falling within the core sphere of an organization's cybersecurity team. Often organizations completely blinded to all the back doors that they're putting into their networks as a result of that, combined with, you know, Internet of Things, so fridges, kettles and toasters all being connected into our internet as well. This is potentially opening up a huge number of side doors that's going to allow the criminal into the vault. And I guess, you know, when we talk about, you know, Carbonac, that's really where all of this started.
I guess going on to Carbonac, and one of the other things we were talking about a moment ago was about knowing your asset base, knowing an organisation, knowing what devices and pieces of software are being used. And that's a really important exercise from a information security perspective that needs to be undertaken, because at that point you then know where your vulnerabilities are, where your data is stored, and it forms part of your GDPR compliance programme. Which it's all about being proactive, not reactive. And I think historically organisations have been too reactive, when actually if they've been taking positive steps, they'd be able to prevent some of these incidents. So I guess looking at Carbonac and giving a bit of a summary of what happened there, you have a series of organised criminals all over the world who, through a series of targeted phishing emails, spear phishing emails, within which they convinced employees at various banks to click on links, open files, allowed them to inject malware onto their computers and into the IT infrastructure, with a view which ultimately led them to the admin PCs and the admin consoles, which allowed them to actually inflate the balances on various bank accounts. So if, for example, if you had a bank account that had $1,000 in it, they'd inflate the balance to $10,000, and then that would allow them for this next phase to empty the difference through various ATMs. So by going down this route, they set up artificially how much was in each account, and then programmed the ATMs to physically spit the cash out.
So they're actually creating money out of nothing. And then turning that into cash.
Into cash. And then in a systematic way, so the criminals are then stood by the ATMs. They know which ATMs they're using, and literally collected it all around the same time and emptied about $1 billion across 100 banks, from 100 banks across 40 countries. But of course, that's only part of the problem, because the ATMs are the ones dispensing the cash. But there's an operational technology piece there in terms of the way the attack actually happens. So that might be something that you have a view on as well.
Yeah, and I think the interconnectedness of everything has enabled this globalization threat to occur. And as we've been saying, we're connecting, CCTV, access control, building management systems, air conditioning systems. If you look at what happened to Target over in America, the attackers actually came in through an air conditioning maintenance portal. So we're no longer having to, break into the vault directly. We're coming in through the stud wall that is the partition between the bank vault and the shop next door. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what operational technology has effectively created, is these stud partitions that organisations don't realise. Mm. We're leaving ourselves horribly exposed, completely blindsided, and often these systems are being managed and maintained by people who don't come from a security or a cyber background. Mm. So they're not aware of the fact that their nice new access control system with the modem in the back of it has just created a backdoor straight into the middle of the banking system.
I think that's absolutely right. And the other challenge that you have with that is it gives a cyber criminal or a fraudster a focus point. The way in which this technology is built is not often with security in mind. That's often one of the lowest points and the lowest considerations. Beyond normal functionality, they want the CCTV camera to be good at doing what it should be doing. Yeah. They don't necessarily want it. They don't necessarily think, well, actually, how easy could somebody, because this is in my network, how easy could somebody could infiltrate, copy, do whatever they need to do to get into to illicitly or unlawfully access it. But the scale of Carbonac was absolutely huge, and I'm sure that there are more organisations out there that are looking at doing similar things. Fundamental problem is I suppose one way of stamping this out is if the staff member doesn't click on the link, the malware doesn't get injected, and does it therefore follow that this attack doesn't happen in this way, or do the fraudsters look at other ways of doing it? And I think this is the challenge in this space. It's a constantly evolving battlefield. Yeah. If they don't get in by clicking on the link, they'll find another way of getting in. And then if you've not prepared properly, and if it's a ransomware incident, you've then got, before you've had a chance to do anything, your backups might be encrypted. And then you've got all sorts of problems there too. And ransomware has very unique challenges. And I know of some organizations that have paid ransomware, and that was their initial response. They don't want lots of money, let's just pay it and be done. But statistically, organizations that are hit with ransomware and pay are hit again, shortly after. The follow-on from ransomware is, where does the money go? Because the ransomware email normally says, I've locked your system out, give me the hit to get the decrypt key, transfer me some cryptocurrency. And I think my view is that cryptocurrency, it's very innovative, it's the use cases are massive, and it will at some point be more widely used than it is at the moment. But there was, I think, until fairly recently, a stigma attached to the likes of Bitcoin and some of the other cryptocurrencies that basically went along the lines of crypto is only there to buy drugs, launder the proceeds of crime and fund terrorism. And it still probably is used for that, because there is this perception that it is it is an easy way to move money and is very difficult to trace. And actually, the underlying technology, blockchain technology, not for all coins, but for the likes of Bitcoin, you know, every transaction can be publicly viewed on Block Explorer. So you can find where your tokens have been sent. You know, you can find even where they may have been sent on after that, if you wanted to look. But for your average person, your average, I've got a video of you on your laptop type ransomware attack, or I've locked all your home systems, pay up or else type attack. Actually, they may not know how to do all of this. And they might think, well, in the scheme of things, yes, I've had to pay £800 or £900, but it's not thousands and thousands of pounds and doesn't warrant that investigation. But I think there's certainly a perception that the virtual currency is also an enabler for fraud. But I also think it's important to distill and dispel that myth, because it's not just an enabler for fraud. There are other, it has some very, very good use cases. You know, some cryptocurrencies are looking at challenging the SWIFT payment system, for example. But what we're seeing now, on top of the initial layer of 70% of fraud is cyber enabled, fraudsters are using technology to commit fraud that they may have done in person many years ago. You're now getting fraudsters that are focusing on, that might still commit those crimes, and rather than saying, pay me in Bitcoin, they'll take money or they'll take assets and they'll liquidate and move it into cryptocurrency, which is particularly challenging to then target, because how do you then restrain those assets? How do you then trace and find out where the wallet is? How do you find out, how do you go to the exchange to get information? And it's a very new and emerging area that we see as a real challenge for asset tracing and civil fraud practitioners. So it's something that we have a real focus on, because I think it will be the future at some point.
So you genuinely think that we can see cryptocurrency being genuinely mainstream, legitimised, and challenging the traditional banking systems?
I think so, yeah. And I think you've got, in some jurisdictions, it's more widely regulated than others. And over here, you have probably what I call light touch guidance from the FCA, which is helpful, that came out in July. But actually, I think there's a reluctance, because it's so new. I say comparatively new, it's been around for quite some time. The concept is not that new, but the kind of widespread knowledge is, in the scheme of things, probably only 3, 4, 5 years old. There's a lot of waiting and seeing, and I think the regulators want to see what the challenges are so that they can regulate at the appropriate way, because of the concerns about fraud, because of the concerns about cybercrime, and because of the not having the technology or the understanding. They have focus groups built around it, but no one knows, and we're at the very start of this journey. And I think as professionals as you and I are, focus on cybersecurity and have that emphasis, it's going to be one of the next things, and sooner or later somebody's going to want to pay an invoice in cryptocurrency, and we're going to need to know how to deal with that, let alone in a business that held cryptocurrency and has had that misappropriated. We're going to have to understand how to speak to our clients about these issues.
Well, I think if there's one thing I've learned in the 30 years I've been involved in the technology world, is that we all too often jump into something because we can, and worry about how we manage it, how we regulate it, and probably at the last point, how we secure it, far too late. And certainly I think, you know, right from the very first virus, we've probably always been one step behind the attack. We're so often responding to a new attack rather than proactively thinking about how to prevent the next one.
Yeah.
And I think certainly when I look at cryptocurrency, I'm always thinking, okay, how is that going to be the next medium by which cybercrime is going to be enabled, facilitated, and committed? Because the criminals are, you know, they are joined up, they are clever, they are communicative, they are sharing ideas with us. You know, you said about with Carbonac, that was not a single criminal. That was not somebody walking into a bank with a sawn-off shotgun. That was a coordinated global crime that was committed there and was worth billions.
Yeah.
So, you know, the amount that we're talking about versus the potential criminal penalties if you get caught.
Yeah.
I mean, you've just created money out of nothing.
Yeah.
And now you've got cold hard cash, which is untraceable.
Yeah. These are sophisticated enterprises that know how to do this. And I think as you said, and I think I said earlier, we're one step behind, we're one or maybe two steps behind them on the curve. And I think it will always be that way, and which is why I think it's important to be proactive where we can. And the more proactive you are, the better you will be at being able to respond to these incidents. And if you can respond properly, hopefully you'll deaden the impact of one of them and you won't be waking up and seeing how and finding out that something like this has happened overnight. And you know, so how do boards deal with that? Well, boards, you know, two of the real issues that I think boards have to grapple with are who's responsible for this. You know, this is a business problem, not an IT problem, when it comes to cybersecurity. Having somebody that really takes ownership of these issues and not just passing it on to the head of IT or the chief information security officer, who may not sit on the board, you know, actually having a board member that's responsible and will take ownership. And also considering supply chain risk, that's a real issue that I think a lot of organizations don't consider enough. What would happen if I was breached? How would that affect my supply chain and the organizations that I supply to? And what would happen if somebody in my supply chain was breached, which would impact the way I do business? Who is ultimately responsible? Do I have protections in my contracts that would allow me to do something about that? What operational difficulties will that create for me? Do these businesses have, are they compliant with cyber essentials? Have they patched all of their software? Have they got unusual devices connected to them? And there's a real innovation point here about securing the supply chain, but it's one of the most challenging areas and one of the areas that I think organizations indirectly could be affected by, particularly where personal data is involved as well. I don't know if that's something that you're seeing some of at the moment.
Yeah, again, especially with the increased focus on data protection that's occurred as a result of GDPR, you know, data controllers, data processor relationships and data handling agreements. But of course, the key element there is knowing your supply chain in its entirety. And, you know, you might know who you have a direct relationship with, but not necessarily who they then have a relationship and who they then, and, you know, The further your data goes down a supply chain, the less control you've got over it, the less assurance you've got over it, the less governance there might be, and therefore the greater the risk. And quite often what we see is that boards aren't cited on the fact that there are many, many people within their supply chain, data going up and down that supply chain on a continual basis, some of it personal information, and the risks that they've created as a result of that.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. You know, this is something that is a board issue, not a technology issue. It's also a people issue.
Yeah,
that's right. You know, most data breaches don't occur as a result of poor technology. They occur as a result of poor behaviour, poor hygiene, poor management, and poor governance.
The better prepared you are, the better you're able to respond. So having your plan is so important. Knowing who you're going to go to, having them onboarded already, so that in the event of an incident, you can pick the phone up and you're not having to negotiate rates with people. You're not having to see, are you available to come on site right now? You've got somebody there. That's what you need to do. And that's why they need to speak to you guys and to us to help with that process.
Yeah, definitely. The quicker you can respond to an incident and the quicker you have access to specialists, the less implications there are further down the line, the less... Yeah. Risk there is to yourself, to your customers, to your supply chain, But also, I think you're right that, you know, organisations need to be much more proactive in understanding their technology, in understanding their people, in understanding their information management, so that they are able to put measures in place to reduce risk and manage risk.
Yeah.
And be cited on risk rather than waiting until it's too late. Yeah, security as business as usual rather than as a...
Yeah, and it's not just a we are secure right now. It's a it's a continuing process, very much so.
So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Security as a continual process. I think that's something that we've talked about, well, probably for as long as we've had Advent, for the last 17 years, we've been talking about security as a continual process. Maybe as we approach 2020, then that could be something that as businesses we could start to take seriously. I've been delighted today to be joined by Chris from Trowers and Hamlin. I've been Mike Gillespie, and this has been the Advent IM podcast. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.